Court is now ready to hear oral argument in the third case. I will call that case. It's case number A24-1054, Daniel W. Crandall and another versus James E. Hansen. I think counsel are familiar with our procedures. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. Our lectern is adjustable. There's two buttons on the front edge of the surface that can make it go up or down. So feel free to adjust it to your preference before you begin. Counsel for appellant, you may approach the lectern. Please state your name and your client's name or names, and then you may begin.
May it please the court and counsel. My name is David Vanderhayden. I represent appellants Daniel and Lorraine Crandall. I'm asking this court to reverse the trial court for the reasons stated in our briefs. I became involved in this matter after the court had issued its spoliation order in the spring of 2022, and after the time for a motion for amended findings had expired, I had the privilege of being engaged by Mr. and Mrs. Crandall. In spite of our inability at that juncture to bring a motion for amended findings with respect to the spoliation issue, which obviously had a significant impact on the case throughout, we brought a request to the court's attention to motion for permission to bring a motion to reconsider the court's decision with respect to the spoliation and the exclusion of all evidence after October 31st, 2019. That request was objected to by respondent, and the court denied that request. First, the district court's spoliation sanction under these facts and law was an abuse of discretion. The spoliation sanction was clearly erroneous because by September of 2020, respondent had received sufficient notice of the potential claim starting in October of 2019 and had taken no action to correct defects, inspect, or safeguard evidence. The facts are clear. The 10/19/31 letter started the notice process from Crandall's to the respondent, Mr. Hansen. There's a text shortly after receiving the 10/31 letter from Crandall's that says, "The weather's not right, the construction season is ended, the ground's frozen. I will be returning in the spring of 2020. Full notice that there was a problem with this construction. Fine, come back in the spring of 2020 and inspect, correct, do what you need to perform the contract." Respondent failed to communicate whatsoever after that point in time, period, but did not come back or communicate in the spring of 2020 as he had promised the appellants that he would return to the job site. So early in June of 2020, appellants retained counsel who wrote another letter to Mr. Hansen saying, "We told you there was a problem here. We haven't heard from you." Looking for the letter here. "My clients have obtained two bids to bring the project into a condition where a properly built wall may be constructed." That, Your Honor, in the context of all the other information, is clearly notice of destruction and replacement by another contractor that's about to occur if you don't do us at least the common courtesy of communicating with us.
Why is that not a demand letter?
For the reasons I just stated, Your Honor, it is, thank you for asking that question, it is a demand letter of sorts. There's no denying that. But it's also a letter that says, if you don't do something, communicate. It's begging for some communication is what it's doing, commonsensically. It says, impliedly, if you don't want to engage with us, if you don't want to contact us, if you really have abandoned the contract, we've hired contractors to at least give us bids, and the implication, clear implication, the only implication you can draw, Your Honor, is that they're ready to repair and replace the retaining walls that were an issue. But it was a demand letter of sorts.
I think the Miller opinion says that a notice is sufficient if it provides the other party with, quote, the time and nature of any action likely to lead to the destruction of the evidence, and then also offers a full and fair opportunity to inspect. So if we really bear down on that language about the time and the nature of any action likely to lead to the destruction of evidence, where do we find that?
Read it to you, Judge.
Well,
taken in consideration with the October 31st letter, I have been told that they would only take the job.
Can you read me again the language that you think provides notice of the time and the nature of the action that's going to destroy evidence?
Well, Judge, under Miller, that's a very general standard. It's not rigid. The court uses that language. This is not a rigid language. It's general concepts of notice. And if you take the October 31st letter, Your Honor, the wall is defective, unfinished, and sinking again. The wall needs to be sitting on virgin soil, or the problem will never go away. There's your notice of defect in October 31st, 2019.
Notice of defect, but not notice of intend to destroy evidence.
Later on in the letter, Your Honor, the same
okay.
October 31st,
I'm sorry to interrupt you.
2019 letter, it says, I've been told that he would only, this is from other contractors, they would only take the job on if they tear everything down and redo the foundation to rebuild to their standards. That's notice that there is going to be another contractor coming to the job who has told me that what needs to occur is there needs to be a tear down. That's in October, Your Honor, combined with the letter Mr. Grindy sent to Mr. Hansen on June 3rd, the language I quoted. My clients have obtained two bids to bring the project into a condition where a properly built wall may be constructed. Both of those estimates, he gives the amount. If my clients are caused to place this matter into litigation, they'll be seeking in excess of whatever the figure was, but the figure was consistent with the bids that he told them he had. Clearly, Your Honor, that is sufficient notice under Miller. Judge, I last night sat down and read six or eight of the cases that are sentinel in this area of spoliation, and most of them are vehicle cases. But the distinguishing thing from ours is that the respondent was at the job site every single day for months. He knew the condition of the retaining wall he himself constructed. This is a small company. He was there on an almost daily basis, laboring, shoveling, building, moving bricks around, building this wall. He had notice of what the condition of the wall was in when he left the job site. And that's really the distinguishing factor here, Your Honor. And frankly, out of all these cases, Miller v. Lanco, Schmidt, Hoffman Motor Company, which is an auto garage fire case, Hirsch General Motors, which is a State Farm subrogation case, the facts in this case are the best facts of all. Respondent gets notice in October, does nothing, gets another letter, November, December, January, February, March, April, May, June, 6, 7 months later, you need to communicate with us or we are going to hire a contractor, tear down the work. Those facts are far superior to any of these other cases.
At the time that the spoliation motion was filed, I understand you weren't counsel at that time, but at the time it was filed, was the 2020 letter presented to the district court as evidence of notice?
Your Honor, I'm glad you asked that question, and I've done some research on it. That letter was part of the trial court record. And the trial court record, Your Honor,
It was definitely a part of the motion to reconsider.
Well, it was also, this is critical, Your Honor, if you'll give me a moment here. Well, I don't even need to find my note. The filing, as I understand an appellate record, the filing of any document. Take me a while to answer your question, please. Allow me an opportunity. The filing of any document with the clerk of the district court becomes part of the appeal record. That letter you were referring to, Your Honor, did you say the June 3rd letter?
Yes.
Is part of the trial court record. It was filed and submitted by the respondent in part attached to an affidavit as part of his submissions in support of the motion for summary judgment. Now, to be clear, Your Honor, this is brought up by counsel as well. That particular letter, for some unknown reason, didn't get argued to the trial court judge at the motion for summary judgment. In that transcript, I looked, it's not in there. That argument doesn't get made. But our view is that it is part of the district court record because it was a filing of an affidavit made by the respondent in this action and therefore is part of this appellate record, and it's fair for this court to consider. The district court, that's a pretty significant finding. The district court made a finding. The only notice was that October 31st, 2019 letter. That is incorrect. It's false. That does not square with the facts in the case that were submitted and filed by the respondent.
But it was never argued that the 2020 letter constituted notice. That argument was not presented to the district court, that this letter is a second notice, and that's the argument being made now.
I agree with that, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's correct. I agree with that.
And shortly after that June 3, 2020 letter, it was in July that your clients got an inspection, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. I mean, wouldn't it have been, part of, I think, the Miller requirements is that there's a full and fair opportunity for the other party to take whatever action they wish. But if your clients were getting an inspection, wouldn't it be fair to give the defendant an opportunity to do an inspection?
Judge, he had several months to do his own inspection.
Well, but
there's not a lot more you could have told him about.
But the passage of time, I'm not sure which way that cuts. I mean, if your clients wrote a letter in October and did nothing for months and months and then decided to do an inspection and then shortly after that file suit, it seems like, to be fair, full and fair opportunity for the opposing party to do their own inspection. It seems like maybe, something more specific at that time would have been appropriate.
Judge, first of all, half of that time period, October, approximately half of that October to June time period, we were waiting for him to come back in the spring, which he said he was going to, which he didn't do. So this is after he fails to do something again that he said he was going to do and doesn't appear. We write him another letter as a courtesy.
The demand letter, right?
It's
I mean what the,
right, yeah.
That's the letter, yeah.
But as a courtesy to him, that we've gone so far as to get some bids, and these bids are going to involve replacement. If I were a contractor, I would be at a minimum getting out to inspect the condition of the walls, take some pictures, hire an expert, do the same things my client did. He chose not to. And one of the reasons he may have chose not to, Your Honor, I think in his own mind, he abandoned the project, and he knew what was there. All these other subrogation cases I talked about with automobiles, there, the other side has no idea of the condition of the automobile that caught fire in the in the Hoffman case, for example, when either the Ford Taurus either got discarded or taken to the salvage yard, the defense had no idea as to the condition of the Taurus, the cause and origin of the fire. They didn't have any information. But in this case, the respondent has all that information he gained from his building and construction of the actual walls.
So, Mr. Vander Hayden, your initial allotment of time has expired. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Yep. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court. My name is Christopher Bowman, here this morning on behalf of Respondent James Hansen. The questions before the court this morning are relatively simple and straightforward. First, did the district court abuse its discretion by excluding evidence gathered after October 31st, 2019 as a sanction for appellant spoliation of evidence? And second, given that exclusion, did the district court err by dismissing appellant's what I'll call design defect or quote-unquote, non-fraud claims? Both of these questions should be answered in the negative, and this court should affirm in all respects. I want to begin, because I believe both parties would agree that the dismissal, this is not a case like Kovaleski versus BNSF, where the district court granted judgment as a spoliation sanction in and of itself, and this court affirmed. What the district court did here is it cut off the time for evidence gathering, said, in essence, told appellants, if you have anything that was gathered before this October 31st, 2019 date, bring it to me, let me hear it, we'll decide, and there wasn't anything. I believe that both parties are, in essence, in agreement that if the spoliation sanction stands, the district court's decision on dismissing the non-fraud claims is valid. All of the evidence pointed to on appeal that says, well, there was a question of fact here, all either existed after October 31st, or excuse me, all was either gathered after October 31st, 2019, or was the 2019 property statement that was generated before any work was done on the property, and not enough, therefore, to show any diminution of value.
Doesn't the second issue depend upon the law of damages? In other words, I mean, I'll just jump right to the question in my mind. Why can't plaintiff prove damages with two canceled checks totaling $11,000? I mean, you know, so plaintiff wrote the checks expecting to get something in return, got nothing, and they lost the money. It hasn't been refunded, I'm assuming.
To my knowledge, it hasn't. There's nothing in the record indicating that it has been refunded.
I read the transcript of the hearing where it was argued by, I think, your predecessor.
Yes.
and District Court readily agreed, but it's just a little bit counterintuitive that somebody, that a plaintiff cannot collect out-of-pocket expenses for a breach of contract.
Again, you know, I recognize that this wasn't the specific issue that Judge Schmidt was asking about, but that wasn't the theory advanced by appellants here either. They were not seeking recovery of the approximately $11,000, the amount that they had refunded. What they were seeking was the diminution of the value of the property, alleged diminution of the value of the property, as a result of allegedly improper work that was performed.
And where do we find which part of the record reveals plaintiff's theory?
The argument, I don't have the date in front of me, I apologize.
The hearing, the oral argument?
Yes.
It's a day of trial, basically.
Yes. I recognize that, you know, there is a reference in appellant's brief in the fact section raising almost a procedural objection, saying, well, look, this was a summary judgment that was brought on the day of trial, and therefore under Rule 5602 was improper. We would submit that that hasn't been adequately briefed in order to preserve the issue under Molina versus Chapman. The court were to look past the waiver argument, they haven't shown prejudice as a result of any procedure irregularity with the district court's action. I want to move into discussing what the bulk of this morning's topic has been on the spoliation. There's been a lot of talk this morning about the June 3rd, 2020 letter, the June 2020 letter. I think it was June 3rd. And Judge Schmidt and Judge Johnson, both of you asked questions that I think hit on the key point. Was this argued to the district court that the June 2020 letter constituted a sufficient notice under Miller? No, it was not. And is the letter itself made part of the record? Respectfully, no, it is not. What is attached to the affidavit that I believe Mr. Vander Hayden was referencing are requests for, or are discovery requests, interrogatories, that in there say the parties exchange letters. The content of the letter is not part of the district court record. I believe it's docket entry number 20. I apologize. I thought I had the district court docket printed with me today. I don't. But it is the affidavit of Mr. Hansen. I agree with Mr. Vander Hayden. That's what he's pointing to. It is an exhibit to this affidavit. The letter itself is not an exhibit to the affidavit, is not a part of the district court record, at least as it relates to the time the spoliation motion was first heard.
Why is this the least restrictive sanction available? It's everything after 2019 is out. And I understand excluding the expert report and the inspection and the records from that, but why wouldn't property tax records be fair game in order to prove up damages or the cost that they did pay to repair be fair game?
I appreciate that question. What I would turn to is the differential standard for this court. The question is not what would this court, what would your honors decide is the appropriate sanction, but rather did the district court abuse its discretion in crafting that? I recognize, you know, your honor is familiar enough with the law that defines what an abuse of discretion is, and if you go beyond the bounds of the law, that is an abuse of discretion. I think possibly allowing those additional records, it becomes the October 31st, 2019 date provides a clear time frame that allows the parties to have an understanding of, look, here's here's a cutoff date as opposed to trying to split hairs down the road, leading to additional argument over, well, how much is going to be allowed, how much is not. And again, the appellant's argument today seems to be, or at least as I understand it, is there no sanction is appropriate here because we complied with Miller. But again, we don't concede that the June 2020 letter is a sufficient Miller notice. Judge Schmidt, I think you were the one that said, you know, why isn't this a demand letter? That's how I read the letter as well. It's a demand letter. The October letter, 2019 letter, I think at most is a litigation hold letter that potentially puts Mr. Hansen on notice that he has an obligation to preserve evidence, but it does not give the custodial party the right to destroy evidence. I also want to note, it is not our argument today that there was any sort of bad faith in destruction of this. Miller, I think, makes perfectly clear that bad faith isn't required. Even good faith, even destruction of evidence in good faith is potentially warranted or may still lead to sanctions. But Judge Johnson, as you raised in your question, there was a significant passage of time here. The district court, perhaps not explicitly, but I think at the very least implicitly, did find that there was a legitimate need to destroy the evidence or to replace the retaining wall. There's some suggestion in the appellant's brief that it erred by not making that finding explicitly, but if you don't get to the rest of Miller unless there's a legitimate need.
Ask, what's the significance of October 31st, 2019? Why did the district court pick that date as the date which determined what would and would not be admissible pursuant to its spoliation sanction?
From a factual basis, that was the date of the October 2019 letter.
Okay, but when did the wall come down?
The wall came down, I believe, in August of 2020. Sometime, you know, Judge Johnson, as you raised, it was shortly after appellants had retained their own expert to inspect the wall, and it was within a matter of a month, plus or minus, of when the suit was filed. But it was the fall of 2020.
I'm sorry, appellants or respondents retain an expert?
I'm sorry, appellants retain an expert. I apologize if I misspoke.
Okay, so then the thinking is, well, they shouldn't be allowed to use that expert report because they tore the wall down afterwards without giving appropriate notice.
Correct.
On the damages issue, I'm having a hard time understanding that. So appellants paid $11,200 for a retaining wall. They claim they didn't get the retaining wall they bargained for. Is there a law that says they can't simply recoup that $11,200? And I guess the question I have is, there doesn't seem to be any genuine issue of material fact that appellants paid $11,200 for a retaining wall they weren't happy with. It seems to be an issue of law whether or not they can recoup that $11,200 as damages. So why doesn't this just at this point, if the spoliation sanction stands, come down to the legal question of whether or not appellants are entitled to $11,200 in damages? Or is your argument there that, well, that's not what they argued as damages below, they're changing theories on appeal, they can't now on appeal ask for the $11,200?
It's the latter, Your Honor.
Okay, and if it's not barred by Thiele v. Stitch, is there legal authority saying you can never recoup your out-of-pocket costs in a contract construction case?
Not that I'm aware of.
Thank you.
Mr. Bowen, I earlier asked your opposing counsel about where in the letters is there notice about the time and the nature of the action to destroy. He pointed me to, now I'm looking at the October 31 letter, he pointed me to two provisions there. One of them is your deadline for completion is November 30, 2019. That's a time. On page 2, he wrote that If he has to hire other peoples, they will tear everything down and redo the foundation to rebuild it. Isn't, you know, so there is statement about the about the nature of the action to be taken. Why is that notice not sufficient then?
I want to note, I have it in a slightly different format. I'm looking at the district court's order quoting the letter, so I apologize if I have the pagination of the letter incorrect. But the, and it's the letter, the October 2019 letter is quoted in the district court's order at appellant's addendum 4, and it spills over to 5 with one line. I disagree with Mr. Vanderhayden that the October 2019 letter provides sufficient notice. Because, again, and even Mr. Vanderhayden today said, well, it impliedly, and the clearance implication is that the wall will be replaced at some point in the future. I recognize that the Miller Court stepped back from, the Supreme Court in Miller stepped back from the Hoffman line that said you need to provide actual notice of a date and time and all of that. So that's probably not practical in a lot of cases. But here, the suggestion is, hey, at some point in the future, something may happen, and I may have to hire somebody to do more work on this, and they may need to replace the wall. Falls, I think, significantly short of the standard in Miller. You know, however lenient or fact specific as that standard may be, this is not it.
I mean, Hansen knew he had 30 days to get an inspection. He should have known he had at least 30 days to get an inspection if he wanted an inspection.
I would disagree with that, Your Honor. Hansen knew as of the October 2019 letter that he had 30 days to come out and complete the project, not to hire an expert, have the expert come out, inspect the wall, because otherwise the wall was going to be torn down.
Well, but he said, the letter says, if not completed, you can expect the next step, which will be legal action.
Next step, which will be legal action, not next step of, you know, sometime in December, I'm going to hire somebody to replace the wall. I do see that my time has expired. Unless the court has any other, further questions, which I'm happy to answer, we'd ask that the court affirm in all respects.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bowman. Mr. Van Heiden, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you. May it please the court again. Judge Johnson, with respect to your question, I was startled with the court's ruling on the motion to dismiss a breach of contract case. I've been doing this for a long time, maybe too long. What was pled in this case was a breach of contract and damages. That's notice pleading, that's all we ever do. You put in your evidence, decide what evidence the court's going to allow. At the instruction and special verdict conference, after the evidence is in, if the court hasn't granted a motion for directed verdict, which this court could have used, you talk about, well, plaintiff, what's your theory, what's your measure of damages? And at that conference, I would have said, diminution in value, Your Honor. You've excluded the cost to repair. So we were left with diminution of value. I gave you a memo 4 or 5 days ago on a brief on damages that talked at length about, in Minnesota, how diminution of value in a property damage case, a building case, there's real estate cases in there, is the appropriate measure of damage. I told her that in the brief, and I tried to tell her that on the Monday morning when she made her decision that I think is improper, it's incorrect, and it is a clear abuse of discretion. There's no legal reason to justify the dismissal of that case on the rest of the damages, Judge Larkin,
the checks, the breach of contract. He didn't, opposing counsel didn't have a very good answer to that because there is no answer. That's part of a breach of contract. If you prove offer, acceptance, consideration, breach, and damages, you're entitled to damages. In this case, not only would there have been the 11-2 or the two checks that were disclosed from day one in this case as part of their damages, it would have included a diminution in value claim, which would have came from the testimony of my clients. What was the value of the property before you entered into this contract with Mr. Hansen? What was the value of the property after he did this defective work? And owners of property can testify as to valuation. You don't need an appraiser. They could have testified to that. And that's what I thought in the week leading up to the trial, this breach of contract case was going to be all about. Fine, I think you've improperly excluded by spoliation all the cost to repair, my expert's damages, but I still have the testimony of my clients. That was the evidence that existed or would have existed in the record had the matter been heard by the court at trial.
Testimony of your clients about what?
The condition of the wall, the breach of the contract, how he didn't perform the contract the way he was supposed to.
What about damages?
The damages would have been the check, the two checks, 11-2, plus the diminution in value. What the value was, and I gave the court a memorandum that it's perfectly permissible for an owner of real estate to talk about the value of their own property.
And specifically, what evidence would have showed a diminution in value between, I think it was 2019 and 2020?
Their testimony.
Okay.
And the property tax statement for at least that year. But they both could have testified as to the reduction in the value. They're left with a retaining wall that's allowing water to seep under the foundation of their home. They had a significant damage claim, irrespective of the court precluding by sanction the cost to repair and the expert report. One other comment, and then I'm going to sit down. Your Honor, you are right on point with respect to the appropriateness and severity of this sanction. The court abused its discretion. This case, Your Honor, if you were, and I don't think you can technically be reasonably fine spoliation, but if you are, the court needed to fashion a remedy that fit the prejudice. The court doesn't bother making that analysis in its fairly succinct order that's required under Schmidt and Patton about the three factors the court needs to look at. Degree of fault, prejudice, and is this going to serve as a deterrence? This was innocent. My clients were innocent. But anyway, I'm going to close with one quote out of the Schmidt case. Oh, I got it right here. This is a case, Your Honors, where it's a product action, a defective saw, and I think the trial court and the appellate court said, we're going to exclude that expert's report. The Supreme Court in this Schmidt case disagreed and found that that was too severe a sanction. Rather than endorse Electric Tools' novel rule, we consider it more prudent to rely on the traditional case-by-case approach. The judge didn't do that in this case. Rather than analyze, is this the least restrictive sanction to address the prejudice, we got the most severe, just about the most severe sanction short of dismissal we could have possibly received over a fairly innocent, given all the totality of these circumstances, a fairly innocent act on behalf of my clients. We consider it more prudent to rely on the traditional case-by-case approach. Keyed to the degree of fault on the part of the party accused of the spoliation, the degree of prejudice, the court talks about this in Miller, citing Schmid, to the opponent in the case. In this case, there was very little fault that could be laid at Dr. Bratzy's feet. That's the guy that did the expert report. Very little non-speculative prejudice to defendant. I'm suggesting that's the case in our case. And a sanction that deprived Schmid of any opportunity to prove the claim. That are the Crandalls. The sanction was not commensurate with the limited fault and prejudice presented in the case. As a result, we can sanction neither the district court striking of Schmidt's expert evidence nor the granting of judgment to Electric 2. I think we have better facts in Crandall's case than were present in the Schmidt case, and I want the court to give that some really serious consideration. Thank you for your time, and thank you for your questions here today.
Thank you for your, thank you to both our, excuse me, both attorneys for your arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.